American people. And just like that, I was a guest, overstaying his welcome. I walked out into the hallway to find an emergency room doing modest business. I had no way to get back to my car. The woman at reception told me, without empathy, that cabs stopped running at midnight. It was 10 minutes after midnight. My agitation caught the attention of a young white guy in the waiting room. He wore oversized sweats with a Yankees hat on sideways and tattoos twisting up his arms. He volunteered to give me a ride. I followed him silently to a crummy Nissan parked outside, the back seat filled with power tools. He asked me what I was in for, like it was prison, and I said it was an allergic reaction. He told me he was in for his fucked up back. He worked construction, and his supervisor wouldn't let him come to work until he got a note from a doctor telling him he was okay. Best time to come to the ER, he said, was midnight on a Sunday. As he turned into the gas station, I was filled with overwhelming gratitude for everyone involved in this episode, from the 911 operator to the EMTs to the African nurse to the no-bullshit doctor to this tattooed guy next to me. I was grateful to be alive in Elkton, Maryland. What a name. Elkton. My car was sitting, not in a parking spot, but next to the gas pump. I stepped out into the darkness and, not knowing what else to do, filled the car with gas. Looking back, I think a part of my 28-year-old self had some cosmic instinct. I sensed that I was barreling down that dark highway from one life into another, away from the New York City I loved and the people there, deeper into the world of Washington, D.C., where I never felt entirely at ease amid the valedictorians and student body presidents, deeper into the business of politics that seemed to require everyone to compromise the reasons that had motivated them to get into it in the first place. A world tinged with duplicity and dishonesty. This was the height of the Iraq War, after all. Within a year, Obama offered an off-ramp from that feeling. After I went to work for him, the rhetorical flourishes and appeals to American identity no longer felt dishonest. Instead, they felt like a noble entry into the redemptive story of American self-improvement. The campaign office hummed with the energy of a few dozen young people who were dissatisfied with all the other choices and committed to the one we'd made. The story we were telling was about an America where historical sins were confronted, people's differences were celebrated, and there was a positive momentum to the American project. As speechwriters, we felt an ease and, yes, a hubris in expropriating American political language for the purpose of electing a singularly talented black politician. I'd grab a phrase from the American air and drop it into the text of some Obama speech. We are the ones we've been waiting for. And it would interact with the culture as if through osmosis. The villains in the story were all obviously discredited to our youthful minds. The warmongers, torturers, racists, climate deniers, special interests, and amoral wealthy who always tried to stand in the way of progress. The compromises to political reality, the occasional hawkish language on terrorism, for instance, or the critiques of capitalism that had to be carefully worded to avoid charges of socialism, felt incidental to the larger project. Facebook was a game-changing force for good that allowed enterprising young liberals to organize their own political communities. Hungary, Russia, and China were a million miles away, but on some level, they would not be immune to the contagion of hope. There was a sense, as Obama seized the nomination and began his final sprint to the presidency, that we'd move so fast and with such confidence that we'd caught the forces of entrenched power by surprise. Like Jackie Robinson, stealing home against the Yankees in the 1955 World Series. Even the financial crisis in the fall of 2008 felt like the universe affirming the rightness of change. This was the moment that Obama's politics led me to, a feeling of forward movement laced with inevitability. Yes, we can. And where was politics directing us by February 2020? Each morning, I'd wake early and instinctively reach for my phone. I'd open the Twitter app and feel my body flush with a mix of anxiety and anger at whatever debate or outrage cycle I was consuming. A cacophony of noise conducted by an incompetent narcissist in the Oval Office. The media available throughout the day would keep you amped about whatever was most triggering in the nation's ceaseless political combat, stealing your sense of certainty no matter what your perspective. The rest of the world was rendered irrelevant, a solar system of distant planets that revolved around our own political dramas, secondary characters to our own self-obsessions. The leaders of Hungary, Russia, and China were finding solidarity with or solace in the brand of leadership in an Oval Office once occupied by men like FDR and Lincoln. The absurd wealth of the richest Americans was like a weight on the rest of the society, evident every time you ordered something on Amazon or logged onto Facebook. Algorithms populated your social media and email accounts with insistent demands for your money or attention, tailor-made to be the logical extension of your past choices, your presumed obsessions, the anticipation of your wants and desires. Still, this endless convenience of consumerism only seemed to highlight the impossibility of acquiring everything you needed, never mind what you wanted. Underneath it all was the gnawing sense that something about America itself was no longer sustainable. But the sum total of American experience seemed to be an insistent affirmation that opting out of this anxiety-inducing reality was an impossibility. No, you can't. The only respite for me was the experience of having two daughters, aged 3 and 5, who were not cognizant of the circumstances of the world around them. My older daughter was just becoming aware of the fact that she was American. It was a knowledge that we'd first communicated to her so that she would understand why we were celebrating the 4th of July. Not to relate the history of the day, but to understand why we were watching a parade and eating cotton candy. It was further driven home for her each time she did one of her favorite puzzles, in which each of the 50 states was an individual piece, represented by an image that spoke to some well-known and well-worn aspect of their identity. The Alamo in Texas, a covered wagon in Oregon, the Statue of Liberty in New York. In this orderly introduction to national identity, incongruous to the actual moment, each of the pieces fit neatly together into a coherent whole. 22. We do big things. For Shandor Lederer, that first reveal of political consciousness was tied up with the sense of things changing. From the new products advertised on billboards to the new political parties debating issues on television. For Alexei Navalny, it was the idea of being the Soviet pioneer, citizen of the greatest nation on earth, only to have that feeling taken from him by West German army rations. For Hong Kongers, it was the blending of civic identity with a China that, they hoped, would evolve to become more like their open city. America lurked in the backdrop. The wellspring of the capitalism and democracy that came to Hungary. The hubristic victor that cast a shadow over a privatizing Russia. The global force that suggested that China's rising technology-fueled prosperity would be accompanied by an opening of Chinese society. My own flickering awareness of being American was tied up with flashing lights and explosions, fireworks to mark the 100th anniversary of the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge. I remember being a small boy on a promenade packed with people. I was terrified by the crack and boom, the disorienting sensory experience of being a child in an adult world, legs in every direction. But the bridge fascinated me. The feat of engineering that made no sense to a child. The stories from my mother about how they tested the bridge by marching elephants across it. The idea of progress tied up with technology and picture books that showed horses pulling carriages that evolved into cars and trucks. My father hoisting me onto his shoulders to get a better look. It was 1983, and I was 5 years old. But I sensed that the Brooklyn Bridge was tied up with the idea of America. We do big things. A few years later, in 1986, I was back in the same spot for the same fireworks display, marking the 100th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty. A queen who beckoned the tired, poor, and huddled masses yearning to breathe free. My 8-year-old self assumed that those migrants, including my ancestors, had literally disembarked on the island where the statue stood. I marveled at the idea of crossing an ocean on a boat and then seeing both the Brooklyn Bridge and the Statue of Liberty announcing an undoubtedly bigger and better life. I remember a soundtrack of patriotic songs, from America the Beautiful to Lee Greenwood's God Bless the USA. All of this was tied up with the Reagan era that shaped my political consciousness. The movie star president whose genial certainty assured me that we were the good guys and the commies were the bad guys. That's what the Statue of Liberty, in some essential way, represented. This was the story we told ourselves. I began to know it in my bones, believed in it deeply, and felt that I lived at the center of the world. My family's story was an American mix of privilege and eccentricity. We lived in a pre-war apartment building between Park and Madison Avenues, with mostly Latino doormen to save us the inconvenience of opening a door. These were the days before the really big money took over the city, though. My father was a partner at an antitrust law firm. My mother took care of us. She'd been a magna cum laude graduate and president of Bryn Mawr College. But her career trajectory as a woman met the 1970s end of being an assistant to a series of men. I was sent to a private all-boys school along with the sons of other lawyers and doctors. Today, it would be the sons of hedge fund managers and investment bankers. The school dated back to 1628. A creation of the Dutch who governed what was then New Amsterdam. A piece of trivia that reinforced my connection to some mystical American thread. I wore the prep school uniform of jacket and tie, which assured that, in the rough-edged 1980s New York of street muggings, I had the occasional baseball cap stolen, or was chased until I took refuge in a doorman building. The fact that it was almost always black kids chasing white kids was part of another unspoken aspect of American reality. On some level, I just knew we deserved it. The eccentricity derived from my origins. My mother's family were quintessential New York Jews. They'd come over at different times from different places, Russia, Poland, and Germany, though no one claimed those nations as part of their heritage. They were Jews, mostly secular, and loved America with the ferocity of converts. They embarked on the generational ascent from the Lower East Side to Brooklyn to the Upper East Side. They joined the right synagogues and went to City College. My great-grandfather had the preposterously American name Daniel Webster Janover, and used to tip his hat to the rabbi when the sermon started and find a nearby park bench to replenish his spirit. When there were fundraising drives for Israel, he told the rabbi that he preferred to direct his charity to Americans. As a child, I didn't go to synagogue or Hebrew school like my friends. For me, being Jewish was tied up with shopping at Zabar's, learning about the Holocaust, and discovering Philip Roth. We observed the rituals of the occasional Jewish holiday. Seders in Westport with heavily perfumed great aunts, liberal politics, and a cacophony of gossip. As the occasionally youngest child, I'd sometimes ask the four questions. Why is this night different from other nights? The lesson I took was not religious, but political. We got out in time and made it to the promised land. My father's family came from Texas. As far as I knew, they'd lived there forever. Though my grandmother's people were Germans, who came over after the European revolutions of 1848 didn't work out. I was raised with stories of my grandfather's ancestors, who'd fought with Sam Houston for Texas independence and been granted a parcel of dusty land as a reward. My grandparents had been schoolteachers before my grandfather settled into a lifetime job working on the Exxon refinery in Baytown, then a small town, now a suburb of Houston. My dad raised us with stories of his matriarchal grandmother, a mother of eight boys with names like Clyde and Mac, willing them through the Depression. Then stories of uncles who'd fought in Europe and the Pacific. As a boy, I'd visit the family farm in a tiny central Texas town called Pert. To a New Yorker, it was unimaginably quiet and vast. You'd open a creaky metal gate and follow a dirt road to a mobile home. The annual family reunions featured Methodist prayers, giant glasses of artificially sweetened iced tea, and shooting guns at beer cans. My father had grown up attending segregated Robert E. Lee High School, punched his ticket to Rice University, earned a law degree from the University of Texas, and moved north. I was formed from these opposites: a Jewish mother from New York and a Christian father from Texas, a liberal Democratic mother who came of age revering the Kennedys, and a conservative Republican father who revered Ronald Reagan, a woman of the 60s who dabbled in drugs and protest politics, and a man of the 50s who loved Willie Nelson and long drives. An American love story in which each had disappointed their parents by marrying after meeting in Lyndon Johnson's Washington, breaking the unspoken promises of their identities. My mother was supposed to marry a Jewish doctor from New York, and my father was supposed to marry a Texas debutante. They have the best marriage of anyone I know. Decades of exploring new frontiers of identity in each other, and in so doing, becoming more alike. A melting pot of two. Growing up, it wasn't hard to see the strain caused by this American story. Even as a child, I could sense how both sides of the extended family saw the arc of my parents' lives as communicating that they thought they were better than where they came from. My mother for marrying this WASP, my father for leaving Texas for the Upper East Side. During my teenage years, my mother became painfully estranged from her parents. The proxy for this rift was a dispute over a family business that made fillings for cakes. Inexplicably, there were endless lawsuits trying to claim my mother's shares, which hardly amounted to a fortune, but carried the larger emotional weight of inheritance. My father drifted further from his Texas roots. The Jimmy he was in Texas became the James he was in New York. At the end of one visit to Baytown, as my teenage self pouted over a barbecued lunch, my kindly grandmother fixed me with smiling eyes and asked if I knew that my father once told a fib. He had promised, when he left Texas, that he'd come back. Even then, I knew that this remark was intended for his ears, not mine. Out of this mix, my brother and I had a relatively happy upbringing that, despite our privilege, somehow placed a chip upon each of our shoulders. Perhaps because we had no clearly defined tribe to fall back upon, and because our parents had become exiles from their own tribes, we both carried a restless ambition. a desire to prove ourselves to some unseen audience, to validate the choices that our own parents had made, to do big things. To me, this explains the strangeness of the career heights we reached in our 30s, when he became the president of CBS News while I was working in the White House. The fact that we both entered some form of public life is less surprising. In our heterogeneous household, America was the secular religion. Despite their differing perspectives, which my brother and I would end up mirroring, him leaning right while I leaned left, my parents were ferociously patriotic. It wasn't a flag-waving patriotism. It was a sense that America could offer people who might otherwise feel like outsiders a sense of belonging, a story within which to center themselves. We made pilgrimages to Philadelphia's Constitution Hall, George Washington's home at Mount Vernon, and the Alamo. The news was always on, and we were expected to have opinions about it. We were raised to see baseball stadiums as cathedrals, rock concerts as rites of passage, blockbuster movies as communal sacraments, and the American literary canon as key to understanding ourselves. We honored the wartime heroics of distant family and the anti-Vietnam War protests of my mother and her friends. We heard the Lost Cause version of Confederate military greatness that was drilled into my father in school, and how my mother had memorized Lincoln's Gettysburg Address as a child. We learned how America had turned away Jews seeking refuge from Nazi Germany, and how Americans had liberated the camps. These contradictions were embedded within the American experiment. Race was an occasional subject. I could tell my father carried a shame over aspects of his upbringing. His first friend had been black, a little boy who drowned, but my young father hadn't attended the funeral. With pride, we heard how his family had resisted recruitment into the Klan, the citizens' councils that sprang up across the South in the first part of the 20th century. We heard stories of the eccentric uncle who welcomed my Jewish mother to Texas with a stiff drink out of the trunk of a car. My mother had been shaped by the Civil Rights Movement and had a connection to Andrew Goodman, one of the Jewish boys who'd been killed in Mississippi. She'd urged us to read Baldwin, Ellison, and Wright, writers who opened a different window onto America, even as reading them as a white child of the 1980s reinforced an implicit perception of black people as other, an experience that could make me feel shame, but that I couldn't fully understand. While racism was unequivocally cast as wrong, it was also something that was insidiously permanent in its presence. My father occasionally reminded me of this reality, citing the old truism that compared racism between North and South. In the South, they don't care how close blacks get as long as they don't get too high in society. In the North, they don't care how high blacks get as long as they don't get too close. In retrospect, I see that we were a well-meaning white American family who, unwittingly, found a sense of selfish virtue in America's narrative of racial progress, which never actually solved structural problems. The secular sainthood of a Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., or the courtroom heroics of Atticus Finch. It was a subject that we engaged from a position of a privilege that we didn't question. My world growing up was an enclave of Manhattan. I remember that I used to go with my father to park our car in a garage across the 59th Street Bridge in Queens. For years, the parking attendant was a kindly, older black man named Booker, whose world seemed to be within the confines of that garage. He was always there. He and my father struck up a New York friendship of brief sports conversations and family inquiries, deepened by the impression that Booker shared Southern roots. When Booker died, my father gave his family money for the tombstone. I remember feeling good about this gesture. I don't remember seriously considering how I could square my own sense of America with the factors that separated my family's life from Booker's. A man who worked every day of his life, but couldn't afford his own tombstone. There, but for the grace of God, went I. In 1991, when Operation Desert Storm began, my 13-year-old self wrote in a journal, "War. War is upon us." In my mind, I was like a British child in the Blitz, my life about to be connected to big and dramatic forces, accompanied by a whiff of danger. Instead, the Gulf War was over within weeks. The whole thing was like one of those blockbuster action movies I'd grown up watching. A concise series of images and special effects with an underlying message about a greater good. Here was Wolf Blitzer, narrating green tracer fire like fireworks over Baghdad. Here was Stormin' Norman Schwarzkopf, a modern-day Patton in desert camouflage. Here was unflappable Colin Powell, standing in front of maps, symbol of a hyper-competent military and of racial progress. Here were the noble Kuwaitis, liberated from the boot of oppression. And then, a few months later, here I was, a young American, watching our heroic troops march down the Canyon of Heroes for a ticker tape parade, just as the Mets had done after they won the 86 World Series. In my patriotic frenzy, I felt a smug supremacy to the naysayers, the no blood for oil crowd, those who had predicted a desert Vietnam. Of course, there was the history that I did not yet see. The plain fact that oil interests did motivate our concern over the tiny desert kingdom of Kuwait and would blind our nation to the looming danger of climate change. Or the fact that the liberated Kuwaitis lived not under a democratic government, but under a king. Or the fact that after the Quick War, Saddam slaughtered the Iraqi Shias and Kurds whom we had encouraged to rise up against his rule, hardening tensions among Iraq's sectarian groups in ways that would shape my own time in the White House. Or the fact that the stationing of troops in Saudi Arabia, the heart of the Islamic world that I knew nothing about, would trigger Osama bin Laden, a man who had received CIA support during the 1980s, to start a terrorist organization named Al-Qaeda that would bring the war to my hometown, creating a peculiar set of circumstances that would lead America back into war in Iraq under the leadership of George H.W. Bush's son. Those were the shadows of things unseen. At the time, there was no reason not to trust the grandfatherly President Bush, as he boasted of licking the Vietnam syndrome and building a new world order. Hadn't that been the lesson of the dizzying array of events that had recently unfolded? The inevitability of history, observed from the comfort of my cocooned childhood? I watched it all on television. When Sandor Lederer's life was transformed by the fall of the Berlin Wall, my parents marveled at the sight of Berliners deconstructing this symbol that had shaped their lives. I saw it simply as the natural order of things, the good guys winning. When Alexei Navalny was watching grim-faced Soviet military men briefly depose the reformer Mikhail Gorbachev in a coup, I had little doubt that they would fail to stop the momentum of history, embodied by the bearish Boris Yeltsin on top of a tank. When Bao Pu was watching his friends get gunned down in Tiananmen Square, I assumed that the Chinese student standing in front of a tank would prevail. The New World Order. The 1990s were an anticlimactic Cold War epilogue. A victorious America struggled to figure out where to direct its energy, what it was all about. With the drama of ideological conflict and looming nuclear war lifted, politics shifted to smaller preoccupations like budget deficits, trade agreements, government spending, and the residue of the 60s. Debates over draft dodging, abortion, the war on drugs, and hip-hop lyrics. The burgeoning internet contributed to a sense that technology was the new frontier. The power of personal computing and the rising stock prices of dot-com companies replacing the wonder of going to the moon or the societal reach of businesses that actually built things. A succession of relatively insignificant cultural phenomena consumed national attention. From the O.J. trial to the grunge rock wave, from the death of Princess Diana to Bill Clinton's affair with an intern. The world at large seemed to present a series of loose ends to be tied up, from the Balkans to the Middle East, a mop-up effort for the American hegemon. Hungary was safely in the Democratic column. The Russians were privatizing their economy, which would inevitably make things better. The Chinese were opening things up, while their uglier authoritarian side was the subject of scolding efforts like the Tibetan Freedom Concert. At home, my father's life was upended by the policies of the man he had revered. The Reagan-era gutting of antitrust laws put his firm out of business and him out of work, forcing him to scramble to assemble a law practice out of his accumulated knowledge and contacts, while big corporations got bigger. This ultimately led him to work for a time on real estate transactions, helping to construct deals that made more money for other people than for him. His focus, like my mother's, remained on ensuring that my brother and I could have opportunities that exceeded his. The ceaseless momentum of the American dream. In politics, the partisan combat grew bigger as the issues became smaller. The Gingrich Republicans presented themselves as in some civilizational struggle against a competent Clinton administration that accepted a conservative consensus around fiscal austerity, deregulation, free trade, and fighting crime. The era of big government is over. It was hard to tell what it was all about. My own politics took a strange journey through this turn of the millennium landscape that can be best understood through two political campaigns that bookended my university years. In the summer of 1997, after my freshman year in college, I worked on the re-election campaign of Rudy Giuliani. I was indulging a conservative contrarian streak that I'd cultivated against the dogma of my left-wing prep school. Giuliani, after all, was the guy who cleaned up New York City, wiping out crime while splitting the Democratic coalition through his courtship of labor unions, particularly cops and firefighters, the salt of the earth. For a time, I arrived at work early and put together the packet of relevant news stories that would go to the senior campaign staff. I attracted the attention of the communications director, a chain-smoking ex-reporter named Sonny Mandel, who affectionately, I think, nicknamed me Little Shit. She set up a desk for me in her office, and I got a running education from her, alternatively bantering with and cursing out reporters on the phone. I was put to work as a tracker. Essentially, I would take the subway to wherever the Democratic candidate, Ruth Messenger, was doing an event. I'd linger in the gaggle of reporters and record her every utterance before taking the subway back to the corporate-style campaign office to transcribe her words in search of a gaffe. It was a campaign designed around the idea that Messenger was a danger to New York's Renaissance. A woman who said that sex shops gave Times Square character. What I missed at the time is that the methodical corporate takeover of Times Square may have steamrolled the peep show joints that I'd sneaked into as a teenager, but it also brought with it the relentless pursuit of profits and the same kind of real estate dislocation that had motivated Sandor Lederer and Alexei Navalny half a world away. Faceless, moneyed interests, remaking neighborhoods with no regard to the human beings who lived there. For me, the bigger lesson of that campaign was the city I discovered. I'd follow Ruth Messenger to the South Bronx, Deep Queens, and Staten Island, places I'd rarely visited before, places where people like Booker lived, a collage of bodegas, small parks, railroad bars, housing projects, ethnic food shops, dollar stores, pizza joints, promenades, baseball fields, public libraries, and Democratic clubs. New York was suddenly a diverse tapestry that extended beyond Manhattan, a city where people weren't particularly benefiting from the fact that Manhattan drivers were no longer inconvenienced by squeegee men trying to wash their windows at stoplights. In Giuliani's New York, the better off were less inconvenienced, while others were shunted into the shadows of the rising city. By the time I returned to college, turning down an offer to stay in my job through Election Day, seeds of doubt had been planted about the politics of people like Giuliani. This transformation was completed for me when, the following summer, I was fired from a job at City Hall on the morning I was supposed to start work. Someone had discovered that I once got a summons from the New York City Police Department for urinating on Amsterdam Avenue. I was suddenly cast out on the wrong side of Giuliani's idea of law and order. Attending Rice University completed my leftward journey. It wasn't my schooling so much as my surroundings. Like New York, Houston had its share of alluring diversity and Texas eccentricity. But there was also an America I hadn't experienced before. The suffocating sameness of chain restaurants. The towering highway crosses of evangelical Christianity. The racial politics. The isolating reality of the garden-style apartment complexes where I lived. A growing downtown of glass office towers centered on the oil and gas industry, churning out the wealth that sustained the people, filling their cars in the city that unfolded in characterless neighborhoods in the flat distance. Something about that America terrified me. It had a sedating quality. Television and religion and sports, wrapped around a job that made other people money. Meanwhile, when I went home, I saw New York continuing to change as well. Kids just a few years younger than me were being chauffeured around in SUVs that they summoned with cell phones. All this money was being created, but it wasn't at all clear to me what that money was creating. I studied ancient Greece and Rome at school and began to wonder what big things the American Empire was building. What monuments and ideals were we creating that would be worthy of study thousands of years hence? Or were those all behind us in that century that spanned from the dedication of the Statue of Liberty to the end of the Cold War? By 2001, I was back in New York politics, working for the city council campaign of Diana Reyna, a dynamic young Dominican community organizer. The actual boss was a machine politician named Vito Lopez, a tall and bulky man with a comb-over who worked out of the storefront Democratic Club in Bushwick, Brooklyn, one of those neighborhoods on the edge of being colonized by hipsters. Vito was an Italian blessed with a Latino name that allowed him to appeal to the borough's changing demographics. He understood intuitively the link between ethnic neighborhoods, affordable housing units, gentrification, and winning elections for state and city offices. He was obsessed with people showing him respect, a topic he regularly discussed like a mob boss. If someone had crossed him, he'd talk about sticking an arm out. A pragmatist, he endorsed Republican Governor George Pataki in exchange for one favor or another. He was on his way to becoming the head of the Brooklyn Democratic Party, until his career was capsized by allegations of sexual harassment against his younger female staff. I loved that campaign. In my room in a shared apartment in Queens, I was a young graduate student writing short stories, working odd jobs, and getting a master's degree because I didn't know what else to do. My one problem? I was a writer without a subject, accumulating short stories about alienated men living in garden-style apartment complexes in Houston. I'd board the G train and make the ride to Bushwick. Then, I'd walk the few blocks to the storefront Democratic Club, listening to songs by Radiohead about alienated young men. A heart that's full up like a landfill. A job that slowly kills you. Inside, the one constant was usually Vito, wearing an oversized and untucked shirt, barking instructions, working the landline, greeting visitors. My friend Carl Camilucci was the 24-year-old campaign manager, and we'd take smoke breaks outside like hardened emigres to the neighborhood. Diana's sisters came and went, along with a mix of local Pauls, union guys, precinct captains, the kind of people who could deliver votes to the number. Vito was a genius at counting votes, and I was assigned a rotating series of odd jobs. He'd figured out, for instance, that there was a growing Chinese population in the housing projects, so I would write a letter about the issues that concerned them. Vito had a guy who could translate it into Chinese, and he would slide it under every door that bore a Chinese name, an algorithm that lived in his head and his neighborhood contacts, before the tech companies made data harvesting easy. At some point, someone would make a run for canned beer, and we'd sit there drinking deep into the night, a strange collage of New Yorkers. I'd lived the two ends of American politics within the span of a few years. The Republican corporate-funded machine of the Giuliani juggernaut, weaponizing fear and grievances and promises of more cops being more aggressive on the streets, and the ethnic equation of the Democratic machine, tallying up a winning number of constituents based on ground-level appeals and bite-sized government programs that didn't alter the structure of things. On some level, I knew this. Election day was Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, the only election day that mattered in Brooklyn, the Democratic primary. After voting in the Queens School for the local machine politician for mayor, Peter Vallone, I caught the G train to the Democratic Club. Then I was deployed to a polling site on the Brooklyn waterfront with a clear view of the World Trade Center. Just under 10 years later, I'd sit down in the White House with Barack Obama to write his speech announcing that we'd killed Osama bin Laden to avenge what I saw happen next. The point Obama wanted to end with, he said, was the idea that America could do whatever we set our mind to, that we could do big things. The previous decade had upended American life, reorienting our national purpose into a global war against a few thousand terrorists, a war that had taken us back into Iraq and further derailed any possible effort to address that creeping sense of alienation in American life, the arguments about small things, the dehumanizing blend of 21st century capitalism and technology, the disregard for whatever was happening to people in places like Hungary and Russia and Hong Kong, never mind Bushwick or Houston. As an aside, Obama mentioned to me that he really meant it. Killing bin Laden was an incredibly complicated, precise, and difficult enterprise that took years of painstaking work. It was like putting a man on the moon. If only, he briefly lamented, we could devote that kind of effort to something bigger than killing someone. 23. Forever War. When I play back the tape of September 11th, 2001 in my head, I see the shadows of everything to come. The unraveling of the American empire and our social fabric, in a few interactions. I was loitering in front of a polling site near the Brooklyn waterfront in the minutes before the attack unfolded, handing out Diana Reyna palm cards and eyeing my counterpart from the rival Democratic machine, when a cop shooed the two of us down to the corner to get legal distance from the voting. My mind was on looming death. Our family dog was scheduled to be put down later that day. In a matter of minutes, we were back in front of the polling site, staring at the smoke pouring out of the World Trade Center. The cop started to get updates on his radio, which he occasionally relayed to us, our only source of information because cell phones didn't work. A small plane had hit the tower, he told us. Perhaps it had taken off from one of New York's airports. The fire department was on the scene in huge numbers. For these brief minutes, I could sense that he, like the rest of us, did not know exactly what he was supposed to do, whether this event implicated him in any direct way, whether the election would still go forward, whether the appropriate thing was to stay at his post or abandon it. We stared at the smoke in silence. We all knew people in Lower Manhattan. Then we saw the second plane plow into the second tower. The cop's eyes opened wider. Soon he was on the way to his car. There'd been a total recall of the city's emergency workers. Get in your car and head to Ground Zero. He was a young, white guy, probably in his late 20s, handsome in the way cops are. I always wondered what happened to him. In my mind, this cop is all the people we threw at 9/11. Troops doing multiple tours, waving on a screen at halftime of the Super Bowl from Iraq or Afghanistan. Wounded warriors with prosthetic limbs. Or vets returned to militarized police forces. After the first tower collapsed, I walked away from the polling site. I wandered in no particular direction with the vague idea that I'd find some store or restaurant with a working TV. An older man stopped me on the street and gestured in the direction of the fire. "This is sabotage," he explained in a thick French accent. "Sabotage, sabotage," he kept saying over and over again. I nodded in agreement before moving on, leaving him there, gesturing. In my mind, this French guy is the rest of the world, trying to warn us against the overreaction they expected from America. I walked to Bedford Avenue, the heart of hipster Williamsburg, which incubated that mix of detached irony and precise observation that helped shape the popular culture of the 2000s. I had helped friends move there over the last couple of years, unpacking station wagons and SUVs as if it was a second turn at college. I ran into Sarah Heller, a poet in my creative writing graduate program, a kind Jewish girl with an old soul and long, black, curly hair. She took me into her book-filled apartment, where a few of us sat silently watching television together. When I got up to leave, she gave me a long hug and urged me to take care of myself, as if sensing the surreal journey my life was about to take. In my mind, Sarah is liberal America, highly educated, isolated in our enclaves and groups, searching for meaning. I wandered down Bedford. The street was full of people who'd come outside to be near one another, crowded in front of bars with names like the Turkey's Nest. People with hands over their mouths. People with dumbstruck looks on their faces. People in long, quiet embraces. Years later, we would have all been inside, glued to Facebook or Twitter in numbed isolation. I noticed a large SUV parked illegally on the corner. A muscular white guy in a tight t-shirt stood menacingly in the driver's side door, glaring at everyone and no one in particular. The radio was blasting Howard Stern, who was ranting about reported images of Palestinians celebrating in the streets. Stern's was the first voice I heard demanding vengeance. In my mind, that guy in the truck is the American right wing, talk radio and Fox News, the momentum of negative impulses that would become less about fighting terrorists and more about rubbing it all in the face of Americans like me and Sarah Heller, until it reached its logical expression in the person of Donald J. Trump. I walked across the bridge connecting Brooklyn to Queens, which offers a panoramic view of Manhattan. A man had set up a camera on a tripod, capturing images of the giant cloud of black smoke and office debris and human remains drifting in the clear blue sky. This was one of the last seismic events that took place before cell phone pictures. So I was forced to consider how the event looked through someone else's camera. It seemed ghoulish, photographing all that death. But I understood that the scene demanded attention, the horrible grandeur of it. the unuttered reality of what the image signified about where the world was headed. There was a before, and there would be an after. This was a suspended present. In my mind, that photographer is the American media, captured by the bigness of a story that offered the elemental aspects of fear and vengeance, good and evil, fetishizing images of terror without trying to understand it, looking away from other aspects of American life in search of something sensational. Eventually, I found a subway that could take me out to my Queens apartment. The subway car was half full of people riding in silence. A man who appeared to be of Arab descent sat with his legs wide apart, head in hands, overcome by emotion. Nobody sat in the row of spaces on either side of him. He seemed to know that his life in America was about to be transformed. Years later, when I shared this anecdote publicly, my usual collection of right-wing trolls insisted that I'd made up this man, as if it was necessary to refute the obvious fact that someone could have anticipated that the story of 9/11 was anything other than the beginning of a glorious morality play of people donating blood before the nation went off to win a war. In my mind, that man is every person who has become the other in post-9/11 America, from Muslims falsely accused, to Sikhs beaten up, to refugees turned away, to black people assaulted by police in repurposed armored vehicles, to families separated at our southern border. In the spring of 2019, I taught a class in presidential speechwriting and U.S. foreign policy at UCLA. One of the speeches we studied was George W. Bush's address to a joint session of Congress a few days after 9/11, in which he seized control of American politics and, for a time, global events. In it, he defined the heroes and villains of our new epic. On one side, first responders Rudy Giuliani, the members of Congress who sang God Bless America, faithful Tony Blair, the soon-to-be-created Department of Homeland Security, the law enforcement personnel and intelligence professionals who would be handed the authorities of the Patriot Act, the military, preparing to once again fight and win wars, a great nation stirred to action. On the other side, Al-Qaeda, a name most Americans were hearing for the first time. "Why do they hate us?" he declared. "They hate what we see right here in this chamber, a democratically elected government." It was reassuring to have this unfathomable event framed in a way that fit neatly into the American narrative that I'd grown up with, a framing that had little to do with the terrorists and everything to do with us. "Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there," he said. "It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated." America had a new national purpose, on a par with the Cold War, another generational effort to make the world safe for democracy. It was a uniquely effective piece of presidential rhetoric, explaining this horrible thing that had happened in terms that Americans understood intuitively, and offering reassurance that the attacks were merely the preface to a story of inevitable triumph. It pointed the nation in a new direction and led inexorably to action. But the narrative was false. The terrorists hated not so much our government as their own. They hated us for supporting those governments through our foreign and military policies. Defeating every terrorist group of global reach was an impossibility, a recipe for forever war. My students were just a couple of years younger than I'd been when I was roused by 9/11 in that speech. They responded to these words as if they were from another planet. Had the United States really made its entire national purpose a war against a group of terrorists? From the distance of 2019, it seemed an unfathomable error. I asked them to list what they believed were the most pressing issues facing the country, writing them out on a chalkboard. Climate change topped the list. Economic inequality, structural racism, student debt, education, automation, and a host of other issues filled it out. Not a single student mentioned terrorism. Pick a country where the war on terror traveled. Let's say Yemen. In government, I became familiar with the intricate ways that America learned to kill people in many countries in the decade after 9/11. Cold precision. Pick someone out of the harsh desert and take him out. A vehicle, a camp, some mud-walled compound. All of the intercepted phone calls, data, interrogations, intelligence sources, and patient analysis that led to a missile descending from the endless sky. Another terrorist crossed off a list to be replaced by another. The terrorist plots were real, even if their ambitions fell short of the scale of 9/11. Sometimes it was hard to tell whether an attack was actually the responsibility of a terrorist organization or simply the action of an angry, grievance-fueled individual, like the mass shootings that were increasingly common. In 2009, a U.S. Army psychiatrist killed several soldiers at Fort Hood, motivated in part by sermons he'd viewed online by a Yemeni American, Anwar al-Awlaki. Then, more concretely directed by a foreign terrorist organization, a young Nigerian boarded a plane with explosives in his underwear on Christmas Day. No one was harmed. The next year, a printing cartridge filled with explosives was loaded onto a cargo plane only to be detected and intercepted, thanks to a tip from Saudi intelligence. Both of these failed plots had their point of origin in Yemen, directed in part by Awlaki. No one was killed in the Christmas Day or printer cartridge plots, but they seemed to spark more political hysteria than the shooting at Fort Hood. Perhaps the shooting fit a more recognizable American scenario, the lone man with a gun. By contrast, there was zero tolerance for even failed attacks if they were elaborate in nature. The news media was comfortable in the cycle of fear, outrage, calls for vengeance, charges from Sunday show tough guys like Lindsey Graham that the Democratic president was, in some unspecified way, weak. Hours of on-air analysts warning hyperbolically of death on a scale that would account for a single day's emergency room toll during COVID-19. Eventually, death would come to Anwar al-Awlaki when a vehicle exploded in the Yemeni desert, destroyed by an American drone. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. That's what the subsidiary was called. They had an online publication entitled Inspire. Published in English, it was a collage of grievances and pro tips on terrorism. Articles about the American enemy, how-to pieces for making homemade bombs, second-rate religious instruction. I'd sit in endless situation room meetings where people would debate options for what to do about this. Could we block its publication? Did we need to refute its arguments? Did we need our own magazine? The use of English was alarming because it was intended to motivate Americans to commit acts of terrorism. But I suspected that English had another purpose as well. The magazine's creators surely knew they had a wide readership in the U.S. government and intelligence community. It was a form of trolling. Samir Khan, the publisher of Inspire, wrote, "I am proud to be a traitor to America." Khan himself was killed, along with Awlaki. Killing people in Yemen could at times be necessary to protect American lives, but it was also easier than efforts to change gun laws in the United States, which would have saved exponentially more American lives, but which couldn't get through the U.S. Congress. It was also easier than addressing the reality, which extended beyond what any government could do, that too many American men of all ethnicities and religious backgrounds were becoming vulnerable to radicalization. Men living in isolation and fear, numbed by unattainable wealth and omnipresent social media that affirmed your grievances. Far more Americans would be killed in the decade from 2010 to 2020 by white Christian Americans with guns, motivated by that information flow, than would be killed by Muslims. Throughout Obama's time in office, America's military engagement in Yemen steadily escalated, a smaller war amid America's larger endeavors in Iraq and Afghanistan. I remember one cruise missile strike targeting what were apparently terrorist training camps. Our military had the capacity to monitor airstrikes through aerial imagery. One general spoke about the tiny images of people that could be seen fleeing the scene of the explosion. They were called squirters. The word stuck in my head. Individuals being stripped of humanity, rendered into something analogous to the splattering of paint drops on a desert canvas, something to be subsequently cleaned up one way or another. What happens when a superpower devotes trillions of dollars to killing a certain number of people in multiple countries on the other side of the world? Human life itself is devalued. There could always be a justification. Some intelligence had suggested a danger to Americans at home, serving in embassies and consulates abroad, or stationed in the constellation of military outposts stretching from Iraq to Afghanistan. Intelligence that, if not acted upon, could serve as an indictment for inaction, negative media attention, political scandal in the aftermath of a terrorist attack that claimed lives, or even the ones that didn't. In the American mindset, there was also an enduring justification for our actions rooted in the horror of 9/11. But even that justification obscured the deeper reality that America had built a complex infrastructure in the 1980s to transfer weapons to the Mujahideen fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan. That network of supply chains ran through the tribal regions of Pakistan, making use of Pakistani intelligence and Saudi money that facilitated everything from training camps to madrasas for austere religious education. Ronald Reagan welcomed the Mujahideen to the White House as freedom fighters, men of God, comparing them to George Washington. The Soviet Union ultimately buckled and collapsed, in part because of the extent to which they'd been overstretched and humiliated in Afghanistan. America ascended to the position of the world's hegemon. Then, we would go to war against the same infrastructure that we had built, including some of the same men that we had armed and trained, and others who were radicalized by the Saudi money that funded their rigid religious education, and supported by the same Pakistani intelligence service that had been our partner in the 1980s. Drone strikes in those same Pakistani tribal regions. Counterinsurgency warfare against those same Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Secondary wars in places like Yemen. Our effort in the 1980s had generated unintended consequences like the birth of Al-Qaeda, just as our post-9/11 wars have generated all manner of unintended consequences, including the creation of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which became ISIS. In this way, the forever war has actually been a 40-year enterprise at war with itself. In 2015, Saudi Arabia, the birthplace of Osama bin Laden and 15 of the 9/11 hijackers, the source of the oil money that fueled decades of radicalization around the world, went to war in Yemen. A Houthi sect that had long been a rival to the Saudis had seized control of the capital. The Houthis were aligned with Iran. The new Saudi defense minister, an heir apparent to the throne, Mohammed bin Salman, wanted to send a message that he was an assertive character, while using the war to consolidate his control over the kingdom's foreign policy. He was, according to some reports, 30 years old. Tentatively at first, America participated, providing logistical and targeting support. The Saudis were, after all, our allies, and the machinery of our government was built to support them. Obama was ambivalent, but he was ultimately persuaded that by participating, we could be a moderating force on the Saudis. It was soon apparent that this wasn't the case, and this war would escalate when Donald Trump came to office, offering a full embrace of Mohammed bin Salman. Hundreds of thousands of people would be killed, displaced, put at risk of famine. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula was fighting the same Houthi enemy as the Saudis were. So the United States, nearly two decades after 9/11, was fighting on the same side as Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Such was the logic of the forever war. The unintended consequences of our forever war go far beyond the creation of more terrorists and perpetuation of more war. This enterprise has also set a particular kind of example while defining America anew in the eyes of the world, an example that has been a gift to the forces of authoritarianism and nationalism, and an albatross around the neck of values that America is supposed to represent. Ching Chong, the Chinese journalist who was once imprisoned, compared the beginning of the war on terror to that moment in the 1990s when the Chinese Communist Party embraced nationalism as a source of legitimacy and control. "The moment I could tell that the U.S. was going to be tied to a more nationalist approach is the Patriot Act," he told me. To people around the world, he said, the United States that many wanted to believe in was a pluralistic haven that embraced universal values from the equal administration of justice to the sanctity of civil liberties. "But the Patriot Act itself violated the spirit of your founding fathers," he argued. The American consul general in Hong Kong was unhappy when Ching Chong shared this view in an interview at the time. But Ching Chong refused to meet with the U.S. government representative. In his mind, America had already set a new nationalist authoritarian course for itself. The Patriot Act was one of many American laws and measures put in place after 9/11 under the guise of anti-terrorism. Some of this infrastructure was surely necessary to prevent terrorist attacks going forward. But these measures set in motion sweeping powers to conduct surveillance, to restrict immigration, to detain people without trial, to torture people in the custody of the American government, to kill people in other countries. Some of these excesses were curbed or reformed in the years that followed, and Americans could defend individual measures at a given time, as I often did in government, from the use of drone strikes to the surveillance of telecommunications. But the sum total of this apparatus remained a sprawling, securitized enterprise and sent a signal to other nationalist authoritarian leaders who were more than happy to draw the same conclusion as Ching Chong. Those same powers could be used to restrict immigration, target political opposition, shut down civil society, control the media, and expand the power of the state, all under the guise of anti-terrorism. The securitization of society, the demonization of the other, far-reaching laws of social control branded as counterterrorism. These would prove potent tools. Vladimir Putin had already been waging a brutal war in Chechnya before 9/11. But when he used security and anti-terrorism laws to transform Russia into an authoritarian cabal where he controlled all aspects of Russian politics, he could nestle these measures under the wing of the American hegemon and its shared commitment to fighting a global war on terror while bristling at America's moral standing to criticize him. Xi Jinping also embraced the American war on terror as a template and a justification. The Chinese Communist Party built an infrastructure of mass surveillance that took the Patriot Act to the next logical step of making maximum use of all that reach into the lives of their citizens. In 2014, after Uyghur attacks took dozens of lives in Xinjiang province, China's media began to refer to China's 9/11. Xi set in motion the crackdown that would lead to a million Uyghurs being thrown in concentration camps by calling for a struggle against terrorism, infiltration, and separatism. China, he said, should show absolutely no mercy. According to secret documents that were leaked, Xi urged the Chinese Communist Party to learn from how America waged the war on terror after the 9/11 attacks. The Chinese called their own effort the People's War on Terror. Several Uyghurs were held in the prison at Guantanamo Bay. None of them were found to pose a serious danger to the United States, Instead, they were among many people detained after 9/11 in Afghanistan, largely for the crime of being there. After Obama took office, as he tried to close Gitmo,